Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, a podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in learning about the everyday creative lives of people and the things that they made, this program is for you. I'm John Kay, your host of Artists and Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 20 of Artists and Ancestors. You know, the studying of historic needlework offers a perspective into the complex lives of women that's often not presented in the written records of the 18th and 19th centuries. Material culture scholar Susan Scholler authored the book Connecticut Needlework, Women, Art, and Family, 1740 to 1840. This book includes pieces from the Connecticut Historical Society's rich collection of period needlework. In my conversation with Dr. Scholler, she explains how needlework from bed rugs to samplers provides a more complete accounting of the values, aesthetics, and lives of women in Connecticut. Scholler received her Master of Arts from the University of Delaware's Winter Program in 1978, and she completed her Ph.D. in American Studies from Yale in 1994. And today she's a museum curator at probably one of the most prominent historic sites in the United States. That is George Washington's Mount Vernon Estates. Before we move on into our interview, I wanted to encourage folks to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the podcast here. We've been getting a lot of great downloads and stuff, but I'm not hearing back from people. Would love to have some good feedback via iTunes, or you can go over to artistsandancestors.com. Let me know your thoughts. Would love to hear from you. Let's move on into our interview with Dr. Susan Scholler.
I'm Susan Scholler, and I am currently curator at George Washington's Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens in Mount Vernon, Virginia. Before that, for a number of years, I was director of museum collections at the Connecticut Historical Society, and that got me interested in Connecticut material culture and artifacts and arts of all varieties, and I have long been interested in women's history. Having done a dissertation at Yale on images of women in the art of the American West. And so these different interests just came together in the project Connecticut Needlework, Women, Art, and Family, 1740 to 1840.
What really attracted you to that needlework of that period?
The project really got started with looking at the Connecticut Historical Society's needlework, costume, and textile collection and thinking, wow, this is really an amazing collection, and this is a really underutilized treasure at the Historical Society, materials that had not really been published or they'd been published occasionally. They'd been researched a little bit, but kind of in a smattershot fashion. And then going back to when I was in college was when women's history was just really getting started at the university level. And at that time, it was really sort of a matter of let's study famous women. And that really didn't interest me too much. But then I did graduate work at the Winterthur Program at the University of Delaware, and one of the people that I encountered there, who was the curator of textiles at the Winterthur Museum at the time, Sue Swan, she was writing a catalog of the Winterthur collection of needlework, and she was very interested in it from the perspective of women's education and women's history, not just looking at samplers or silk embroideries or mourning pictures as the forms themselves, but really using them as starting points to understand the history of women and women's education. And she made the point very fervently that this material, needlework, represented in many cases the only tangible remains that we had of virtually half of our ancestors from the 18th, early 19th century. And I, as a growing up, I did some needlework myself, so it's a media that I have a personal connection to in a way that I don't to furniture or silver or pewter, which I very much enjoy and I understand intellectually, but I'm not a woodworker, so I don't really have a feel for it in my hands, if that makes sense. And I do have that connection to the needlework.
I think that that's a common thing that I'm hearing from a lot of people, that there's a certain tactile or phenomenological approach to this material, where they are drawn to it because of some physical aspect of material culture, something that they know how to do, but then it also engages with them intellectually through that same medium.
Yeah, I think that understanding how to make something, having some experience of the materials, the process, gives you an understanding of it on a different level than simply studying it.
I agree. For those that might not be familiar with Connecticut needlework and the samplers that you're talking about, could you just describe that for us? What's a traditional one look like? And I'm sure that's a little bit of a hard question. I'm sure it's quite a wide array of things, but could you just kind of describe a little bit what we're talking about?
Sure. Well, that is a hard question, and I'm currently struggling with how to write an entry for the Online Encyclopedia of Connecticut History on Connecticut needlework in 1,000 words or less. So for me to be able to give you a summary in a few brief sentences is going to be even harder. But it covers really a vast array of forms. We're talking specifically about decorative needlework, not about the plain sewing that would have been used to make sheets and towels and clothing and that kind of thing. So we're talking about embroidery. We're talking about canvas work, which is the 18th century equivalent of today's needlepoint. We're talking about how the embroidery is then used to make specific forms, two-dimensional forms like samplers, pictures of a variety. Really, they could be religious pictures, allegorical pictures, mourning pictures, also used in the 19th century to make family registers. I also looked at early quilting, which is referred to as whole cloth quilting because the decorative top is a single or a plain piece of cloth, and the decoration is made by the lines of stitching. So I was really trying to look at all forms of decorative needlework created by stitching, produced from about 1740 to 1840, whether it's pictures, whether it's things that were used as clothing items, or whether it was bed hangings, which was a principal form of embroidery in the 18th century. So that's really jumping around, but one of the things I was interested in doing that I think was different from many previous needlework projects or studies is that people have typically looked at needlework by specific forms, so that people have looked at samplers as one category of works, or they've looked at silk embroidered pictures, or they've looked at bed rugs, which are a particular form that come out of Connecticut. And I was really interested in looking at change over time and looking at the whole range of what was being produced within a specific region.
What did your study of these artifacts, this large swath of artifacts, what did it tell you?
There were a couple of conclusions that came out of it, and some of them may be specific to Connecticut, but I think others probably have a broader range. And one of the things was that I went looking for by the design of the project, as we had looked at other forms of material culture made in Connecticut, and this is true of research going on in other media elsewhere, for instance, furniture, pewter making, silver making, metalworking, engraving or printing, is that these craft traditions tend to be passed down in families, or what we refer to as workshop traditions, so that the skills are passed from father to son or nephew or cousin. And so there's a continuity. And in furniture, for example, you can often recognize this by the way construction details are done, the way joints are made, or the way particular significant index features, we call them, are, you can see them being passed down over the years. With needlework, it's a little harder because women would make whatever form of needlework happened to be in fashion, so that in the 1750s and 60s, say, it might be crewel work, worked with a wool yarn, typically in floral patterns, often used for bed covers, sometimes for clothing, pocketbooks, rarely for pictures. In the next generation, say, in the 1780s, 1790s, the young ladies in the family might be sent to formal girls' academies, and they might be making very elegant silk embroideries, allegorical pictures, mourning pictures, and so forth. And in the next generation, they might be making white work quilts or samplers. So visually, there's not a connection that you might see. But when you begin going deeply into the family histories of these women, you can see connections that there are needleworkers in various generations. And perhaps you can't prove, but you can imagine the continuity of these skills and motifs being passed down, so that you know a girl is, she's got an aunt who is an avid needleworker, but you can imagine who she would have known, who she would have come in contact with, what else she might have seen.
Things that you're describing here, we've had some former interviewees on the program. Jennifer Kaur from the Tennessee Sampler Survey was on the program several months ago, as well as Laurel Horton, who were talking about some of the same types of things, about the fact that this was a very period style of work, of needlework. You could do almost genealogical type of work through these pieces and try to figure out where people were. I think Laurel was looking at a certain style of a woven cloth that she actually was able to connect perhaps to a girl school in some of her work. And Jennifer Kaur was saying the same thing. How do you go about connecting the material culture to the written record and the life histories and the genealogical information that kind of provide that cultural context that allows you to extrapolate a little bit bigger?
Well, a number of types of needlework, samplers, for example, we're very lucky because they typically include the maker's name, often the town she came from, often either a birth date or an age or a date of making of the sampler. And these data give us a starting point for the girl that we're looking for. And I think that the project that I worked on, this Connecticut Needlework Project, probably could not have been done or couldn't have been done in the same way or in the same amount of time even 10 years ago, because the Internet has given us access to just such vastly expanded resources to be able to track down historical individuals. And the many individuals out there who have put together family trees, that you can begin to get a hit on individual women who may not show up in the historical record in any other way than vital statistics. I was also very fortunate to be working, you know, with a specific geographical area, the colony and state of Connecticut, and I was working at the Connecticut Historical Society, which has an exceptionally strong research collection on Connecticut genealogy and families that came from Connecticut. And although Connecticut is a small state, it's a very old state, and one of its chief products for many years in the 19th century was people, so that people from Connecticut went all over the country, which makes Connecticut genealogy a tremendous resource for people doing genealogy in many other places throughout the United States. And I have to say that what I did in terms of the genealogical research was pretty quick and dirty, because there are entries on 70 different pieces of needlework in the catalog. And so that meant I was looking at 70 different families, and I was on a timetable where I needed to produce something like 3 entries a week. So, it was compressed enough and painful enough that I'd forgotten the details of how fast I was doing them. But basically, I didn't have time to spend more than a day or two looking for somebody's genealogy. And if I couldn't find it in that amount of time, we did have a professional genealogist, and I could turn some questions over to her. But there are a lot of published genealogies, and so I would start there in the family genealogies to see if I could find a hit on the person I was looking for. I would do an internet search to see if I could come up with a hit. So those were the two sort of easy pathways in through things like AncestryLibrary.com and Centris records and church records that have been put out there. And one of the themes, I guess, that I came across quickly on that gave me sort of something to look for in the genealogical research and other sources, town histories, which can be very rich for finding out about these people. But very quickly on, it seemed to me that many of the women, particularly the earlier you went in the 18th century, had ties to ministers and to Yale graduates. Mm. And so these were families that had long traditions of education. They were well educated. And so I started looking, as I was doing the genealogies, I was looking for connections to Yale because that was the higher education establishment in Connecticut. I started looking for ties to ministers, and that was a way of connecting some of these people. Like in one particular case, which was really fascinating, I had a bed rug and a bed rug is a particular needlework form that seems to be associated with Connecticut. It emerges in the late 18th century. It is worked on usually a plain, roughly woven woolen blanket, and then it is sewn with thick, generally homespun yarns to create these very bold patterns. And they're very heavy textiles, and they're very bold and bright. And there are a couple of different techniques that are used. We had a bed rug that had been in the Connecticut Historical Society collection for many years, initialed by a woman named Betty Foote from Colchester, Connecticut, and it's actually discussed at some length in a chapter written by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich in her Age of Homespun book. And there are just a handful of bed rugs that use this same technique in the Betty Foote bed rug, which is a flat needlework technique. It's basically like counted thread embroidery, and it creates something like a darning pattern. And I acquired for the Connecticut Historical Society another bed rug that, instead of being blue and white like the Betty Foote bed rug, was a polychrome color. And they were so similar that I really very strongly felt that they had to be related. The woman who made the polychrome bed rug, which was signed Laura Collins and dated 1786, I felt she had to in some way be connected to the earlier maker, Betty Foote, whose bed rug was made probably about 1778. But I couldn't find the connection. We identified three Lorraine Collins who were of the right age and, you know, time frame to have made the second polychrome bed rug. But based on the genealogical information alone, based on the dates alone, you couldn't say that it was one or over the other. And none of them lived anywhere close to Colchester. So what was the connection? But I kept looking and going through the family genealogies. And finally, I figured out that the second bed rugs maker, Lorraine Collins' mother, was a sister to Betty Foote's husband. Mm. And Betty Foote's husband was a minister. So you could imagine that the younger woman, Lorraine Collins, had been sent from her home, which was in Litchfield, Connecticut, which is up in the northwest corner, probably, maybe 40, 50 miles from Colchester, to live with her uncle and aunt and be educated in perhaps his parsonage school, and also to learn needlework from her aunt. So here the family histories gave us a clue to be able to attribute this piece of needlework that otherwise would have been a mystery, which one made it and what was its story.
I think that that's the type of research that really kind of enlivens me, that I get really excited about when you're able to take the very limited historical record and look at the material culture and really make them come together and tell a much richer story about individuals, and then take that story of individuals and tie it in with a social historical context. You mentioned Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and she's really championed using that approach to create these kind of micro histories where objects and individuals kind of allow you to look at larger movements that are happening and tie it with larger historical pieces. Did you find anything like that, where the stories that you were uncovering opened up doors to understanding the historical context a little bit better?
Well, I think so in many cases. I think the example of the bed rugs is a good one. One of the things that Laurel, what I've done in Connecticut Needlework builds on what Laurel had done and goes a little bit further, is that Betty Foote, who was making this first bed rug, a blue and white bed rug, she was also, a little bit before she made the bed rug, she was going to school at night. And she did not come from a particularly educated family that I can tell. Her father was a farmer, and they seem to have been simply rather straightforwardly yeoman farmers in the Colchester area. But Betty Foote was going to night school, both day and night school, while she was sort of keeping up her family household, her family's household, and doing a lot of textile production. And in the fall, a couple of years later, I think she then got a country school to teach, which was in the next town over. And then she ended up marrying the minister in yet another town, all very closely related in that area, which was, I think, socially a definite move up for her, that she was able to, you know, demonstrate in some way through her needleworking, through her getting an education for teaching school, that she was a suitable wife for a Yale-educated minister, which, as, you know, perhaps just an ordinary farmer's daughter, she might not have been. Their son then also went on and went to Yale and became a minister. And so there's a clear upward, you know, social and cultural trajectory there, that the needlework is part of that strategy. And I think you can see that in many families, that the needlework is not just, you know, sort of a frivolous luxury, but it's often part of a family strategy of either maintaining a certain social level and demonstrating that that's where you are, or it can be aspirational of helping to move a family into a different social strata.
It's interesting. I interviewed, as I mentioned before, Jennifer Kaur, from the Tennessee Sampler Survey, and she said the exact same thing, that the one thing that surprised her most out of all of this was the fact that how socially mobile people were trying to be. Yeah, they would come from a lesser educated status, and these pieces of needlework really pointed towards aspiring towards education, aspiring towards a better life for their family. And I think that that's a very American narrative that a lot of people could, you know, look at. The sacrifice of one generation towards the next kind of comes back as a recurring theme in the United States.
Well, absolutely, and I'm really interested to hear you say that she's seeing the same thing in Tennessee, because of course it's a very different time and place from Connecticut. But I think, you know, the link between needlework and education is something that emerged for me as another very important theme that kind of goes contrary to a lot of what has long been written or understood about needlework, that you frequently find quoted. There's a fairly famous sampler that was made in Kent County, Delaware, around 1800, and it says something like, Patty Polk did this sampler and she hated every stitch in it. She'd rather be reading. And so you get this sense of there being an opposition between needlework and, for lack of a better word, book learning. But that's not at all what I saw in Connecticut. In Connecticut, the making of decorative needlework is very highly, very strongly correlated to higher levels of education, so that the women who are doing needlework are often among the best educated women of their time and place. And that was something that was a bit of a surprise for me, but I think, you know, really opens up a rich area of research and interpretation and rethinking all of this.
Right. I think that there's also a common narrative of rural folk, homespun, needlework as being on the edge of poverty. And a lot of the work that you're probably looking at is actually not necessarily those people in the lowest strata of society, the hard scrabble, but actually people who are do have an upward trajectory.
Well, I think so, and it's by and large, doing this kind of fancy work, if you will, this decorative work, required having enough money to invest in imported goods. I mean, crewel work is a good example in the 18th century, because the crewel wools that were being used were imported from England. It required a long fiber wool that in America we simply weren't raising the kind of sheep to produce that kind of wool. There is something that is referred to as crewel that you see in account books that women are spinning crewel, but my understanding from other textile scholars is that wasn't fine enough crewel to be doing this kind of embroidery. But during the colonial revival period, the late 18th, early 20th century, this mythology is out there that keeps talking about, you know, the crewel being homespun and my great-great-grandmother spun this wool from the sheep on the farm. Well, no, this was expensive imported stuff. Being able to buy this stuff, to work to do the needlework, said, I have connections to a cosmopolitan world.
Exactly.
You know, I am looking beyond my local horizon. So there are a lot of multiple meanings to this.
Right. Definitely. Let me ask. I've got one more question. Then I want to move in a different direction. And don't let this catch you off guard. I like to ask people, so what? Why should, you know, we live in an era where, you know, people are thinking about money, they're thinking about job security, they're thinking about all types of things. Why, as scholars, are we paying attention to this material from the past? What makes this research important?
Well, the easiest response is to say, because it's there. And that's really a simplistic response, but I think that the presence of this material, it is in many ways unfamiliar to us, and people are this material, the samplers particularly, because people know that the samplers, I think, were often made by very young girls in their teens or even earlier. People are really amazed at the intricacy of the work and the skill that goes into it, and it intrigues them. And so I think doing the research on it expands what you are seeing. So if you see it, you know, visually, you react to it on one level. But if you do some research on the background, the people who made it, the context it was made, it allows you to enter imaginatively a different world. And I think that provides perspective on our world and our lives. And, you know, I'm a humanities scholar. And so I think anything that allows us to reflect on our own lives and get perspective on ourselves helps us lead fuller, richer lives and connect with other people better.
I agree totally. I think that there are two other aspects to this. I think there's also the fact that, you know, we have a history of having a very undemocratic history, undemocratic showing of who makes it into the record books, who gets noticed. And in some ways, I think in contemporary times, it's become even more so with popular culture and that sort of thing. And many of these women that you're talking about, young women mostly, as you said, this might be the only thing that records their life. Many of them maybe didn't even live to be adults. And I think having a more democratic history is important for us to understand the context that produced these works. And the second part is also to help us chip away at that notion of the myth of the pioneer, the ruggedness, and look at education and look at people learning skills, learning to connect with others is really a way of finding a way forward, I think is true as well. Maybe that's a little idealistic on my part. I don't know. But both of those seem to be important things for us to look at in looking at these materials.
Well, I think absolutely they're both important stories. And, you know, I mean, having discovered women's history, I mean, I think if you do women's history seriously, the premise is that if you look at our standard narrative of history from the viewpoint of women or from other groups who may not be part of that, you know, top-down version of history, you see things differently. And that's really important. We all know at this point that, you know, sort of history is rewritten by each generation to use the past, if you will, the search for a usable past to help us understand our own time and our own generation. And I think these are two very important avenues. I got really fascinated by a lot of the early family histories that were written in after the Civil War through the early part of the 20th century. And they're very, by and large, they're very patrilineal histories. But they're also very chatsy because the people who were writing those histories in, say, you know, if they're doing their research in the 1850s or 1860s or 1870s, they were going out and talking to older relatives who were then in their 70s or 80s. And those older relatives had known an even older generation. So you've got a very close link almost to the generation of the end of the colonial period and the revolution and the beginning of the American national period. And they had memories of these people. And so when I find a notation in one of these early histories that said, you know, something like, you know, Aunt Mary was, it said something other than Aunt Mary was a pious woman. You know, if it said something about her being wise or learned or, you know, very often you get little comments that just clue you into someone that had a strong personality or was interested in education or just, you know, went beyond that sort of standard conventional norm. So, you know, while there's a lot of folklore, and there may be misinformation in these, they also have a lot of fascinating little clues, and I think they're in many ways an underutilized resource.
I agree very much so. I want to, at this point, kind of shift gears because you've got a very interesting job now, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that and what you're working on these days.
Well, yes, I am privileged to have a great job at a great place. And, you know, there's a saying out there that, you know, you hear the saying very often of George Washington slept here in various places. And I want to just paraphrase that and say that, you know, I mean, George Washington is the preeminent great white man. But his life touches on so many dimensions of the American experience. And as you begin to study him and learn more about his life, it is fascinating on so many levels. So what do we do here? Well, you know, one of our main jobs is the mansion and the historic area at Mount Vernon. Representing it as closely as possible to the last years of George Washington's life. We say that we want it to be, you know, in some way, if George and Martha Washington were able to come back, we would hope that it would be recognizable in some way to them. So we are always on the lookout for original Washington items that we can bring back to Mount Vernon for comparable, if we can't find the original Washington artifact, comparable period items that represent the kind of thing that they had. George Washington, as you may know and many people do, was, you know, Mount Vernon was sort of the emotional center of his universe. And he left with great reluctance to take up the positions to go to the Continental Congress to accept the position of Commander in Chief for during the Revolution, and then to leave private life again and take up the presidency. But you know, his vision was always that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and Mount Vernon was his pursuit of happiness. So to be able to show that vision, to share that vision with the people who, you know, come to visit here, and to be able to talk about his legacy and how he helped to make that, was really critical in making that a reality for the American nation, is fascinating. And beyond that, it's just a wonderful place. We are fortunate in having an average of around a million visitors a year, and it's just really great to, you know, go out on the estate and see people who are really, you know, making a point to learn about history, who are enjoying themselves, and who are, you know, combining that learning and enjoyment.
I actually, this last year, I was doing some work at the Library of Congress with my day job with Traditional Arts Indiana. And we took my 10-year-old son there to Mount Vernon and had just a wonderful visit. It's such a beautiful spot, and you all do just such an amazing job telling the story, and just an amazing resource. You all are in constant preservation and restoration of the work there. I really found it to be wonderful.
Well, that's great. We're always glad to hear from satisfied customers.
Well, very satisfied, very satisfied. How about research-wise? Are you working on anything with that, or is your work there keeping you focused in on the operations?
Well, I've been at Mount Vernon for a little bit less than a year, so I'm still on kind of a learning curve. It turns out there have been a few books written on George Washington, so there's a lot of reading to do. We have a traveling exhibition that is going around the country. It's currently at the Minnesota History Center called Discover the Real George Washington. And in conjunction with that, I did a talk down at the North Carolina Museum of History on a topic that they had asked for, which was Martha Washington and the decorative arts at Mount Vernon. And because the curatorial department here is largely focused on the mansion and furnishing the mansion, although we also have, as you know, for visiting an education center and museum gallery, which enables us to show many of the things the Washingtons had that do not fit or would not be able to be seen in the mansion itself. But it turns out, which I hadn't realized until I came here, that Mount Vernon is also a, in addition to being the story of George and Martha Washington and historic house, it's also a great collection of American decorative arts, because Washington began acquiring goods to furnish his home in the 1750s and continued acquiring things until after he retired from the presidency in the 1790s. So you have a nearly a half century spectrum of American taste as represented through one household. And because Washington's writings are so extensive, there's just great documentation on it. And also because something that belonged to Washington, people typically treasured and remembered it, and so there's often great provenance. So we can put together really a fascinating story about American tastes. And Washington was always very concerned about the communicative value of artifacts, that artifacts communicated to his visitors, to his peers, you know, who he was and ultimately what the new nation was to be. So anyhow, that's a long preamble. But as we've looked at the decorative arts here at Mount Vernon, it's usually been from the perspective of George Washington, because he wrote most of the documentation. His papers run to some 90 volumes. Martha's published papers run to one volume. And she destroyed almost all of the correspondence between herself and George Washington. So we focused really on George Washington and the decorative arts story, and the people who have written about Martha Washington have not really dealt with the stuff in any sort of systematic or extensive way. You get maybe a paragraph or two that talks about the goods that she brought to Mount Vernon from her first marriage. So there was really this kind of lacuna of you know, Martha Washington and the decorative arts being talked about in two separate categories. So one of the things that I did was to look at the collection and try and think about what things that we know survive or were documented, can we connect specifically to Martha Washington? And so you come up with things like, of course, we have only one complete dress, but several pieces of fragments from other dresses. We have significant amount of her jewelry. We have her needlework. Turns out she was an avid needleworker. Who knew? I certainly didn't until I came here. There are also things that we're fairly certain she brought to the marriage from her first marriage. There's silver acquired for her son's wedding in 1774. So you can put together a story that, again, begins to look at all of this from the women's history angle. And I thought it was interesting. The audiences in North Carolina seemed to think it was interesting, so that's been fun to work on, and I think there's a lot more to do with that. And then we're also working on an exhibition that will open in February of 2012 that has the working title of Hoe Cakes and Hospitality, Cooking with Martha Washington.
Oh, that sounds good.
So I think it will be fun. It kind of, you know, we have several, as you know, from visiting, you see the two dining rooms in the mansion set for various meals. We have another dining scenario representing the presidential dining table at the Executive Mansion in Philadelphia. But the idea of the exhibition is to kind of look behind the scenes and say, hey, you know, this is one of the premier cooking operations in the country at the end of the 18th century. They are entertaining literally hundreds of people per year at Mount Vernon. What's the behind the scenes? How did Martha Washington, who was in charge of all of this, manage to, you know, manage the whole production, preparation, presentation operation to put dinner on the table for all these guests? And so we're looking at some of the original kitchen utensils that survive, some gardening things, Martha's recipe book, her copy of Hannah Glass's cookbook. So a lot of, you know, things that we will hope appeal to new audiences that perhaps have not connected with Mount Vernon, and bring them to the experience here, you know, the foodies, the wine tastings, you know, all that kind of interest that's very popular right now, the whole field to table movement, because of course that's very much what's happening here at Mount Vernon.
That's great. I know that that's a growing audience that's out there, part of the whole slow food movement and the local, the global interest in that which is local food.
Exactly.
Is really popular. This all sounds great. I'm going to have to take my 11-year-old son next year to back to see what you're doing.
Well, so we hope you will. It'll be on for all of 2012. Starting exhibitions here open on the 22nd of February, but it'll be up the rest of the year after that.
Great. Well, thank you again very much for sharing your story with us here on Artisan Ancestors.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Artisan Ancestors with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by me, John Kay. I'd love to hear from the listeners out there to give me some ideas for future podcasts or folks to feature on the show. Let me know that you're listening out there. And until the next episode, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past.